created an unintended business opportunity for cities on the European continent. According to KPMG, the professional services company, more than 60 firms plan to transfer aspects of their UK operations to EU cities, including Luxembourg, Frankfurt, Dublin, and Paris. Frank Langford, NPR News, London.
Officials at Atlanta's airport say operations are returning to normal following a huge power outage Sunday. The airport was closed for hours and thousands of passengers were stranded. Few flights are delayed today, but the Associated Press reports passengers have stood in line for an hour to get through security this morning. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include CDW, offering CDW Cloud Consulting, committed to helping companies develop smart, strategic cloud solutions to maximize their cloud investment. CDW, people who get it, and the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
Republic Services is proud to sponsor This Green Earth on KPCW. During the holiday season, Americans discard 25% more trash than normal. Roughly 80% of what is discarded during the holidays could be recycled, from gift boxes to holiday cards. Recycling during the holiday season helps keep Summit County green. Information about recycling at summitcountyrecycles.org.
From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. More than 500 black bears have returned to parts of their historic range in the Great Basin of Nevada, where the species disappeared about 80 years ago, scientists say.
A new study says genetic testing confirms the bears are making their way east from the Sierra Ranges north and south of Lake Tahoe along the California line.
In some cases, black bears have moved hundreds of miles to sites near the Utah line, marking a rare example of large mammals recolonizing areas where they'd been previously wiped out.
Joining us to discuss this study, how these bears are moving such great distances, and what it might mean to the importance of wildlife corridors in general, will be John Beckman, a conservation scientist with the Wildlife Conservation Society, and Marjorie Matok, a professor at the University of Nevada, Reno, where she studies population and evolutionary genetics of mammals.
Then in the second part of the show, Jason Bartow, certified arborist and executive director with ReLeaf Utah, joins us to discuss something unusual, the idea of watering your trees right now. Why do that, and what's the benefit? Jason will explain.
We don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our email address, thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
G'day, this is Ashley from Campus Coffee, happy to sponsor programming on KPCW. We can't wait to serve the Park City locals this winter. We're excited by our breakfast and lunch menu to complement our espresso drinks. Campus Coffee is open daily at the base of Park City Mountain Resort, up the stairs from the ice rink next to the Adirondack chairs. CampusCoffee.com.
Beth here, owner of Peak Art and Frame, longtime supporters of KPCW. At Peak Art and Frame, we carry a wide variety of framing options, and our design staff can help with any project for your home, office, or gallery. Open Monday through Saturday and located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us to discuss the recolonization of the Great Basin by black bears, we have two guests. We have John Beckman, a conservation scientist with the Wildlife Conservation Society, and Marjorie Matok with the University of Nevada, Reno. Thanks for joining us. Are you both there?
I think we lost Marjorie, but I think we have John. John, are you there?
Yes, I am. It's a pleasure to be here this morning.
Thanks for joining us, John. I think we'll try to get Marjorie back on as soon as we can. But let's press forward here. This is an interesting study, and actually good news for bears and their ears here in Utah, something that we don't usually, we've had a rough time with in the past couple months. So let's start here. The bears are repopulating or recolonizing an area of Great Basin, Nevada. Why did they disappear in the first place?
There's really two factors that caused the disappearance of both black bears and grizzly bears from the Great Basin. The first being habitat loss and change. When you look back, particularly in the mid to late 1800s, what we saw is clear cutting of the forest. And that occurred for two different reasons. If you look in the western Great Basin, so around Lake Tahoe and western Nevada, the timber was harvested to be used as support structures in the underground mines, so the gold and silver mines in Nevada, particularly during the Comstock era, during the Comstock lode in the 1860s and 70s. In the more central part of the Great Basin, where we had pinyon and juniper forests, those forests were clear cut and removed for fuel production, so use of wood to run charcoal mills. And as a result of that, we lost the forested areas that black bears rely on. And the second factor that caused their decline was just the removal of bears for conflict with humans and their livestock.
Okay. And I believe we now have Marjorie Matoke on the phone with us. Marjorie, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having us.
Oh, fantastic. Well, we just started without you. I hope you don't mind, Marjorie.
Not a problem.
John was explaining just the fundamental question about why these bears disappeared from a region they once populated or colonized. And also explain where the Great Basin is for our listeners.
Yeah, the Great Basin as a region includes most of the Nevada, parts of Utah, extreme southern west, southwest Wyoming, and southern Idaho, and south east Oregon. So it's that big basin and range complex, essentially, that sets between the Wasatch Range and the Sierra.
Okay. Oh, so Utah is in play here, is part of the equation.
Extreme western Utah is part of the Great Basin Desert.
Okay.
So with that in mind, and knowing that these bears have been gone for, close to 100 years, is that accurate?
Yeah, bears, the last recorded bear that we had, at least in the state of Nevada, was about the mid-1930s. And so
we've
seen bears gone for about 80 to 85 years.
So in their absence, how might this ecosystem have changed, and what kinds of impacts has that had?
Historically, when you look at the Great Basin, it was a bear-dominated system in the forested areas, and then in the drier sagebrush habitats, you had mainly pronghorn and then bighorn sheep in the rocky talus areas. And then with the habitat changes that I described, you saw not only a loss of bears, but with the grazing practices and the habitat management practices in the forest, that led to an increase in mule deer populations and also an increase in mountain lions. And so over the last 80 years, in the absence of bears, what we've seen is a complete shift of the system, going from a bear, pronghorn, bighorn, sheep system to mainly a deer and mountain lion-dominated system, still having pronghorn and sheep, but the dominant carnivore switching from bears to mountain lions.
That's really interesting, particularly because I was going to ask you how residents of this area are feeling about seeing a big predator come in. You know, as you mentioned, human removal, or I guess removal of this species by humans, was one of the reasons for their disappearance in the first place. So do you have any sense of what the general feeling is about this?
Yeah, it's one of the things that when you look at the large carnivores that are on the landscape, bears are one of the species that, while they can be a predator on livestock, it's fairly rare, because black bears in particular, the vast majority of their diet are berries and grasses and those kind of food sources. And so even though they do eat meat and are technically a carnivore, from their diet perspective, they're really omnivorous. And so the predation on livestock is much lower than one would expect. And so I don't anticipate with bears returning there being a huge problem. That's not saying that bears won't be predators, but it's not at the level one might expect.
But it might be a welcome alternative or to the mountain lions, I guess,
right.
if that population then decreases in response. Is that right?
Yeah, one of the things that we're studying right now is how the bear population, when it's recolonizing the Great Basin, how that's going to impact lion populations, both from their numbers, but also their behavior on the landscape as well. And so we're trying to work out our understanding of that a little bit more currently.
So let's talk a little bit about the study itself and how these bears started. And let's be clear here. These are bears acting on their own, recolonizing. This wasn't a human involvement in reintroducing any of these black bears into certain parts of the Great Basin?
No, this was a natural recolonization of the bear population. And so we wanted to understand not only their demography and the demographics of the population and their behavior, but also the genetic consequences of that. And that's where Marjorie and her work was so important in this particular aspect of understanding this system.
Okay. So, Marjorie, do you want to talk a little bit about the study itself?
Sure. So the study was possible because John and his collaborators at the Nevada Department of Wildlife have long been handling these bears to understand their demography, like he was just saying, but also, very importantly, collecting some samples, so either a small skin biopsy or some blood, so that in our study, we could actually go through and look at the genetic variation in these recolonized populations. So the genetic variation is important to track because especially when we have newly established populations, we want to be sure that they have the genetic resources to continue to respond to environmental change like disease or climate change. So it's not just about having a population establish itself, but it's about making sure that they have the genetic resources to continue to respond to change over time and become self-sustaining.
Interesting. So when did you first notice that these bears were beginning to recolonize this? What was the evidence there?
Yeah, so to set the stage a little bit, in 1979 at the Western Black Bear Workshop, where all the Western states get together to discuss black bear management conservation issues, the state of Nevada Department of Wildlife made the statement that Nevada has no bears, and so they didn't at the time have any management responsibilities for bears. And by the late 1980s, we were starting to see bears show up in the Lake Tahoe Basin and the Carson Range of the Sierra Nevada, which is the range that forms the east shore of Lake Tahoe. And so that's the first time that we started to see bears, and we started to see the conflicts between bears and people mainly around bears getting into garbage, starting to increase. And so we wanted to know if this was a true increase in the bear population or if these urban resources were just redistributing the bears on the landscape by pulling them down into these urban areas, because we had a prolonged drought in the late 1980s that we think was the catalyst for driving some of those conflicts. And so that was when we first started to notice bears really back on the landscape within the 1980s, and by 2000 we had seen tremendous changes on the landscape. Hmm.
So tell us a little bit more about where these bears were coming from. It sounds like they had been sort of removed or extirpated from a pretty large range, a pretty large area, before they started working their way back out.
Yeah, we don't know geographically the exact location, although we do know that there were refugia for bears in the Sierra Nevada and on the California side. And so bears were always maintained in there.
Okay.
And we think that that is the most likely source population for the recolonization.
Okay.
And that's another place that the genetic data was able to give us some further insight, in that those populations that are now reestablished in the Great Basin, they still seem to be connected to those Sierran populations. Largely the movement seems to be from the Sierras into the Great Basin, but the genetic data do suggest that there's still connections between those populations or subpopulations. So that's another place that the genetic information suggests that maintaining those connections or those movement corridors is really critical in this system.
And when you say that the populations are still connected, you mean that there is sort of, I guess, reproduction between those two, that there is movement back and forth?
Absolutely, so that we do have a genetic signature of migrants still moving into these newly founded populations, and even among the newly founded populations or subpopulations. They do seem to be connected, and so in terms of maintaining their genetic variation and continuing to sustain themselves, those movements between the subpopulations are likely very important.
We're speaking with Marjorie Matok. She's a environmental scientist and professor at the University of Nevada at Reno, and also John Beckman. He's a scientist with the Wildlife Conservation Society. We're talking about a report they both helped co-author, which identifies the recolonization of black bears to the Great Basin of Nevada, an area that they were once colonized, but some 80 years ago were disappeared, extirpated, as they say, from human calls or otherwise. And now they're coming back. And I think this is a really fascinating study, not only, you know, looking at bears specifically, but as a species and as a kind of evidence that wildlife on their own are able to recolonize or repopulate areas they once habitated, and do so without human effort or assistance, as long as there are corridors for them. Talk a little bit about the challenge bears have, or any animal species has, in trying to recolonize otherwise human habitat with roads and bridges and man-made obstacles like that.
Yeah, one of the things I would say is that wild bears are coming back naturally. They did have some assistance through some very intense efforts of conservation by right. The Nevada Department of Wildlife and the Wildlife Conservation Society and other groups working together. One of the things that we saw early on is that because Great Basin had not had bears for so long, there were no requirements for people to take care of their garbage. And what we saw is garbage pulling bears down into these urban areas where their mortality rates were very high, mainly from collisions with vehicles when they were down these urban areas. And so over the last 20 years, what we've done is required various areas to bear-proof their communities. And we've seen several million dollars and several thousand bear-proof dumpsters and garbage cans go into the Lake Tahoe Basin, western Nevada. And as a result of that, what we saw is that those negative growth rates in these urban areas actually turned around and became positive growth rates, which is what allowed the bear population to expand more, probably more rapidly than it would by itself into the Great Basin. And so there is some assistance by people understanding the issues and complying and trying to take care of their garbage in these areas where bears occur.
So we kind of have to modify our behavior, too, at times.
That's a key. And then once we saw that, then we saw the natural recolonization of bears. Once we reduced that mortality rate, then we could see the population start to expand fairly rapidly.
Now, John, what else has the Wildlife Conservation Society done sort of in order to, I don't know, set the right conditions or help this bear recovery?
Yeah, so we've worked with the Nevada Department of Wildlife. Myself, have, in particular, worked with Carl Lackey at Endow, and we've spent the last two decades doing a lot of public education efforts. We've worked with decision makers and policy makers to get ordinances in various counties requiring bear-proof dumpsters and garbage containers. We've put out informational videos both online on places like YouTube, but also producing DVDs that can go into various classrooms to educate elementary school-age children. And so we've spent a lot of time on the education and the policy front to try to get bear conservation done in this region.
And with this recolonization, Marjorie, what are your next steps with your study, or will you continue evaluating these populations?
Absolutely. So we will continue to work with John and the Department of Wildlife to continue to monitor, as we've said, the genetic consequences of this natural recolonization. That has implications not only for this system, but for any other system that has the resiliency to recolonize in the way that bears have. And even with the genetic data that we already have, we'll be able to get down into even finer scale analyses to use the genetic information to see exactly what parts of the landscape are allowing bears to move the most and to have the greatest genetic connectivity, and what those habitat correlates of gene flow are, so that we can further inform the kinds of corridors that we need to be maintaining for this system.
So as an example, you might be able to say this particular type of forest seems to be key in their dispersal. Is that the kind of information you can get?
That's exactly right.
And then the state entities can establish policies or procedures or guidelines that help protect or preserve these corridors?
That's right. And what we think is that, or what we hope, is that if we can conserve corridors that serve organisms like these bears, that a lot of other animals in those same ecosystems
right.
will be able to benefit from those same corridors. And, of course, it's not just for movement today, but one of the main ways that these systems are going to respond to change through time, especially climate change, is by moving through the landscape to follow favorable conditions. And they're going to be able to do that only through these types of corridors.
And I would add, too, that what is unique about this system and this study is that in a lot of cases we never have a complete picture, but we don't have as many of the pieces of puzzle as we do in this system. And so it's an opportunity to use bears as a model to understand things like the genetic consequences of a loss and then a recovery or recolonization by a large carnivore, which those types of data can be used for many different species, not only in the western U.S., but across the globe when we think about conservation of wildlife.
Hmm.
Now, when thinking about this dispersal and movement of wildlife, particularly with bears, how big of a role do highways and roads play? How much of a barrier are those? And is, you know, wildlife passage part of this picture as well?
That will end up being a key component to maintaining connectivity for bears and other wildlife. Quite a movement that's begun in the last 20 to 25 years on understanding the impacts of roads and how to mitigate those impacts. And so we are starting to see not only in places like Banff National Park in Canada, but in various states throughout the United States, we're starting to see these crossing structures, both overpass and underpass structures, built specifically for wildlife to enhance their connectivity across the roads, which can be a barrier.
So a listener writes in, if bears can recolonize or are recolonizing the Great Basin, what specifically perhaps other animals can either benefit from that recolonization or may recolonize this area also? Anything in, you know, as you look towards the other species out there?
Yeah, historically, if you look at the Great Basin, and I mentioned this briefly earlier, and I don't anticipate this in the near future, but most people don't realize that grizzly bears were in the Great Basin. In fact, the last known grizzly bear that was removed from the state of Nevada was 6 years after they were declared extinct in California.
Wow.
Not only the two bear species way down the road may be a possibility, but species like wolves and other species. But it's not just large carnivores. We'll see benefits of maintaining this deeper ungulate migrations, so things like mule deer, pronghorn, even bighorn sheep that are moving between mountain ranges throughout the Great Basin could potentially benefit. And a host of other small animals, birds, and small mammals, and plants and habitats as those habitats are managed for wildlife.
So bears act as a kind of a keystone species. You know, they're part of the chain of command in the ecosystems that's critical to ecosystems.
Yes. Historically, they are the top apex predator and carnivore in the system, and they have fairly low densities but large home ranges. And so in theory, if we can protect the habitats and bear populations that they that rely on those, then those will be an umbrella for other species.
Okay.
So as we look ahead, what's next with your research? Where are you taking this project next?
Yeah.
Well, I will let Marjorie answer the genetics component. For the ecological component, one of the things we're currently doing is trying to understand how the recovery of bears back into the Great Basin is impacting other species. And so we are looking at interactions and social dynamics between bears and species like mountain lions and how that potentially impacts prey populations, so populations of mule deer, for example.
Mm.
And then from the genetic perspective for the bears, as I was saying, we can get down into even more detail about the types of habitats and the habitat features that are really facilitating gene flow and connectivity. But we can start to do that not only with the bears, but all of these other systems that these bears may be interacting with. So we can be looking at the genetic change over time in other species that they're interacting with, like the mountain lion populations potentially, or, you know, looking at certain food resources, things like that. So looking at sort of a multi-species genetic connectivity in the Great Basin.
So give us an idea of how you can correlate, I guess, like a genetic trait or signature with a habitat type.
Hmm. So on the one hand, what we can do is that we can look at the types of habitat features that seem to be correlated with areas that sustain higher or lower levels of genetic variation, so that perhaps there's something about those habitat features that are sustaining higher levels of genetic variation. Mm. Across the landscape, we can also look at patterns of relatedness, essentially, between individuals, so that individuals that share more of their genetic signature, essentially, with each other, we can use that information to suggest that they have moved through particular habitat types. And so we can essentially look at a network across the landscape of individual relatedness, and that gives us a sense of the habitat features underlying that are supporting those patterns of genetic similarity.
Now, we only have a couple more minutes, but obviously we have black bears here in Utah. Are these bears traveling, I guess, say, west to east across the Great Basin? Are they going to eventually, I'll say it, hook up with bears, the existing populations of bears here, and you can tease that genetic fingerprint out?
We should be able to. At this point, we don't have samples from further east than Nevada's portion of the Great Basin, but I'm sure that we could find some collaborators in Utah that might be able to share those types of samples with us so that we can have sort of a broader perspective across even more populations,
right,
so that we can track that aspect of recolonization as well, indeed.
Okay, so we got just a minute left. Any other questions? Did you have anything?
No, you know, I was just going to comment that, you know, Chris and I were kind of joking, laughing about this before the show. We're so glad to have this topic on and to have you two joining us today because it's kind of an inspiring, exciting story in the environmental world, and we don't always hear about those. And so it's fun to track the progress of something thanks to actions that humans have done, and it's actually kind of worked.
It works, and it's also, like I say, an indicator of the importance of wildlife corridors, preserving, conserving, and defining these corridors, like you're saying, Marge, the different types of corridors, which ones have a higher priority than others. So if it works, if it works for bears, it might work, you know, for other species that require corridors like this. So the corridor system seems to be also an important component in this study, research. Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
Where can people go if this study is available online? Can people access this study?
Yes, we'd be happy if they can. I don't know if online or otherwise you can give our emails or something like that. We're happy to share more information about the study. Absolutely.
All right. Perhaps we'll post that on our Facebook page or so.
Sure.
We'll do that.
That'd be great.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And the Wildlife Conservation Society, the website for that?
If you go to WCS.org, you can find eventually if you type in keywords for black bears in Nevada, you can find all the information on the organization, but also our work on Great Basin wildlife.
All right. Marjorie Matoke, professor at the University of Nevada, environmental researcher, and John Beckman, scientist with the Wildlife Conservation Society. Thanks so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
All right. Let's take a break for a couple of underwriters and sponsors, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with Jason Bartow with ReLeaf Utah about something really interesting he suggests we do with our trees. We'll be right back.
I'm Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and KPCW sponsor. Epic Promise grants focus on youth programs and environmental initiatives that impact our community. Grants fund programs that help kids achieve great things in the classroom and develop a passion for the outdoors by engaging guests, our local community, and employees to create a more promising future. More information at epicpromise.com.
Support for KPCW comes from the Crandall family, owners of the New Park Amphitheater, site of the New Park Concert Series, and numerous other community events.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us in studio is Jason Bartow. He is executive director with ReLeaf Utah.
Yeah, I've had to take that title on. I prefer still being a urban community forester.
All right, that too.
At heart, right?
At heart. But as we've grown and, you know, spread our roots and our branches across the rest of the state, somebody had to pick up the administrative and the expansion tasks.
My sympathies.
Yeah, juggling multiple balls right now. And if there's anybody out there that wants to be an executive director, we have a wonderful opportunity.
Really?
There. I'd love to be the director of operations.
All right, we'll give people a reminder of that near the end of the interview again. But let's talk about why you're here. A couple of things about the trees and the watering, but also you attended a conference in Tulsa last month, and we'll get to that.
Yeah,
some takeaways from
there. There's some really cool stuff that the rest of the nation, the world, is studying right now.
Okay.
So that'll be our little teaser for later.
All right, good. Well, let's start with this. We've had very little precipitation.
Yep.
And that's not good for trees, per se. Explain why.
Well, specifically, our conifers, our evergreens that still have needles on them, they're still photosynthesizing, albeit at a reduced rate. And there's still microbial activity taking place in the earth underneath. And with the long, dry falls that we have or have had in the past, and they've been warm, we typically turn off irrigation October 1st.
Right.
And then our conifers get no water until next May. And even with some snowfall, because of the needles on the conifers, the snow gets shed away from there. So if we have times like today might be a good day if it warms up midday, 47 degrees.
Yeah, it's supposed to be warm.
To get some water on our trees earlier in December, November would have been great. We want to try to get it on midday when the soil is thawed out enough to absorb the water, with the anticipation it'll probably freeze at night. So we don't want to apply water to frozen ground.
Okay.
Is probably the best way. So midday would be the best time to do it. And right now I would focus on your conifers that get the greatest exposure to sun.
Really? Okay.
And now what about in the scenario, you know, where we have deep snowpack? Obviously at that point it doesn't make sense to water through 2 feet of snow. Is the snow at that point providing enough moisture into the soil or retaining moisture in the soil that the conifers will do okay?
If we had a deep snowpack somewhere, it can. And in the wild, it tends to balance itself out. But sometimes in a landscaped environment, there can be an imbalance. But most of it, if there's snow, if the trees are in a deep snowpack, there's water there, and they're not getting the same exposure to sun that, say, you know, the conifers are along Kearns Boulevard across from the high school properties.
Okay.
So that would be a more priority tree than a tree that sits in the shade all day and maybe has a couple feet of snow around it.
Okay.
Well, you know, we actually got a question or a comment from a listener here that maybe speaks to what you're saying. Trevor says we have several large spruce trees, and the trees that are exposed to wind and sun all have dead branches in the bottom 3 feet. The spruce trees in the shade are doing great, but he found that extra water didn't have measurable positive results. Other trees in the neighborhood seem to look similar. Do you think this is a water issue? What are your thoughts?
That's a complex question, actually. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Without actually seeing the site, my first question would be, when did you do the extra watering? Because it's the timing, not the amount, that is key for us. And extra watering during the summer sometimes can be detrimental to the tree if it's overwatered and doesn't need it.
Right.
So it would depend also when the tree was planted. We discovered this when we had a high mortality rate of conifers that we planted in the fall across the state. And as we reached out to our colleagues, we found out in Colorado they actually have a little PDF that talks about fall and winter watering.
Huh.
And you can go to our Facebook page right now, and there is a link to this that essentially gives you the gory details about what to water, how to water, why to water.
Right.
So I would first have to see, you know, are the trees, when were they planted? Were they watered in the fall? Were they properly planted? We see a lot of trees planted too deeply, and a lot of time the issues don't manifest themselves until the tree's 5, 10, 15, 20 years old. The other key that was kind of thrown out there is exposure to sun and wind. That definitely can stress out the trees more greatly, and maybe a different tree would have been appropriate in that place.
Okay.
On there. So the main gist is look at our climate, go out and check your soil. If it's warm, those conifers are not dormant. They want some water. We're actually doing some cool stuff from what we've learned about air quality. That I just learned this. I thought that all conifers threw out VOCs, organic compounds that can turn into ground level ozone. I just assumed that.
Right.
Actually, only the spruce tree is a major producer of these VOCs, a couple other species.
Right.
So our spruces that we have planted all around here may ultimately start to contribute to less good air quality.
Right. Have an impact on our air.
Have an impact. And I was. And then on the flip side, there are a lot of other conifers that, because they retain their needles, their leaves year round, they provide a better interception of rainwater. and they have more surface area to collect particulate matter, which is part of the air quality equation.
Okay. We're speaking with Jason Bartow, Executive Director with ReLeaf Utah. We're going to talk a little bit about the conference you attended in Tulsa and some of the takeaways that you got from there, what's going on around the country or world with respect to trees and forests and landscapes, et cetera. But how much water are we talking? Is there a rule of thumb?
The rule of thumb is 10 gallons per caliper inch of the tree. So okay. Diameter of the tree.
Diameter of the
tree.
So
if your tree is 6 inches in diameter, 60 gallons of water once a week. And a slow application with a drip hose is perfect. I know a lot of people don't have their water turned on, so that may not be convenient.
Yes.
What I've done in a temporary situation is I'll take a 5-gallon Home Depot bucket or, you know, cleaned out food pickle bucket, and I'll put 2 nail holes in it, and I'll fill that up with another bucket, and that gives me a long, slow dripping,
nice,
just standing out there freezing, splashing the tree, running in.
Or overdosing.
Or overdosing it. So fill up, you know, put a couple buckets around your tree, fill it up.
Okay.
And it'll
be happy.
And it's going to be happier.
Until
again, our trees are always happy.
They're happy, but right now, like you say, they're at risk of being stressed because of the low precipitation rate and low snowpack.
Yeah.
Because snowpack acts as an insulator too.
Yes.
And protects the root system from freezing.
We're a little concerned about this. I saw predictions we're going to go sub-zero Saturday, is it? Friday?
Thursday night, around zero.
Okay.
Friday, same.
So I am a little concerned about, you know, that in a landscape tree, if you have mulch around the tree about 4 inches thick, not touching the trunk of the tree, that's going to help insulate the roots a lot better than turf will. And I know we've talked about water and turf before. Simply put, without explaining it at all, 4 inches of mulch not touching the trunk of the tree is very good for the tree, and it's a heck of a lot better than turf grass.
Thank you. Always happy to hear that. Okay. So that's the watering thing. Again, is there a website that if people want to get, you know, remind themselves of all this information?
Well, the easiest is go to the ReLeaf Utah Facebook page.
Okay. And you'll have information.
It's already updated.
Links.
We're still a little technologically slow in updating our Facebook page, our website.
Yeah.
But I have found myself capable of posting on Facebook.
Congrats.
So this morning I posted the link to this.
Okay.
On Facebook. So go ReLeaf Utah on Facebook. Check it out. Ask us more questions if you'd like there.
All right.
We're happy to share our knowledge.
Perfect.
And our friend's knowledge, which is greater than mine.
Right. All right.
Well, I'm pulling up the page right now, and I see the link here, Winter Watering Tips from Our Friends in Colorado, right at the top of the page. So
perfect. All right.
Easy to find.
Go to download that information there. Now, we got about 5 minutes or so. Let's talk about your trip to Tulsa, the conference. What was that about?
I'm going to talk really fast on this.
All right.
The main topic of the conference was trees and how they contribute to our health. And the cutting edge research now has accepted that trees are good for us. There's a study 2 weeks ago from the UK that said lots of trees are good for us. They're done quantifying if they're done wondering, are trees healthy? They are. And now they're looking to try to isolate the specific contributions that trees, the mechanisms.
Yeah.
Is it more oxygen? Is it the shade? Is it some olfactory compounds being reduced that affect our brain chemistry? This is weird, but maybe the trees are vibrating and that affects our body somehow.
Right.
So we've gone beyond trees are good and trees improve air quality, and we're now looking for specific mechanisms. So that was really exciting. That ties right into exactly what our Healthy Trees, Healthy People program is doing, is to make sure that we have trees that are sustainably planted. We sequestered with biochar, we sequestered almost 10,000 pounds of carbon by planting 22 trees. The trees themselves sequestered about 300 pounds of carbon, but our soil modification mediation with biochar dramatically increase that. So we're throwing a whole lot of carbon now that's in the ground, that's going to stay there, that makes the trees healthier on there. So we're now about planting right. And the other cool things that as people become aware that ReLeaf Utah is here and the skill sets that we produce in our national network, we're being invited now to join in on the Summit County Climate Action Plan.
Good.
Which the 2015 version didn't have the word tree in it.
Right.
And we're collaborating with Park City Municipal on their sustainability plan, which coincidentally also didn't really have much tree in it. And I think a lot of it is people knew trees were good, but there wasn't a resource to help out with now. So if there's another organization, we're multitasking Utah Physicians Healthy Environment, the Healthy Environmental HEAL, the name excuse. But we're partnering with a lot more people to be able to share all these benefits. And we think the health benefits right now are the most important because they affect our quality of life. We see the inversion down in the Salt Lake Valley. If we plant more conifers, we might be able to work on reducing that a little bit. But not just air quality, not just medical. There's all the other benefits that come with the trees. But we're really hoping that the cost savings that we can see by improving health, reducing medical costs, reducing the need on Northwest Philadelphia or Northwest, well, Philly's the same way, but Northwest Salt Lake City, where the fire department EMS is the primary medical care for a lot of people. And when I served on the Salt Lake City Fire Department, that was part of my territory. And one of the scariest emergencies to go on is a pediatric respiratory emergency.
Right.
Because there's really not much to do. And kids, they don't have a whole lot of capacity like we as adults do. So if we can make an impact down there and we can get kids healthier and we can increase property values and someday maybe help affect the inversion, that's, you know, what we're trying to do. And we really need to do it up here because whether it's natural inversion, car driving, I'm starting to see some murky air up here. And we'll be installing some monitors from Purple Air soon to establish a baseline.
Okay.
And we'll be looking at that. But as we've said in an earlier show, the best time to plant a tree is 30 years ago. The next best time is today.
Right.
We need to be planting today, yesterday, the day before, for the growth we have now, let alone the growth that we're expecting.
Okay.
So I encourage everybody to embrace us. Tell your local organizations, county, city, health departments, that we're here as a resource to help you plant the right tree in the right place in a sustainable manner. Using science.
That was science.
I know. Which I know science based is a tough word, but this is how I resist is we are science based.
No, that's critical. You're science based, fact based. And like you say, the studies show that there's physical benefits, obviously. There's emotional, psychological benefits of trees. I like the sound of trees. You talked about the olfactory nature of them or the just the visual benefits. I like the sound of trees too, whether it's the wind going through the conifers or wind through aspen, breeze through an aspen. So yeah, there's a lot of benefits, both physical and mental, spiritual, that we garner from the presence of trees.
We could talk an hour on that side.
Can.
Last concept as we're talking about trees and being beneficial, and that thought just ran right out of my head there.
All right. I'm amazed that that happened.
I wanted to circle back to something that you mentioned several minutes ago, which was that you planted trees using biochar. So tell us what biochar is and why you incorporated that.
The simple explanation of biochar is organic matter is heated to a temperature where it starts to decompose, and that decomposition process is called pyrolysis. If you add oxygen to pyrolysis, you get fire.
Right.
By starving it of oxygen, they cook off the other components, the organic components of the tree. And in the best situations, they actually collect it, distill it, and turn it into a potential biofuel. That's still being worked out.
Right.
The remainder of the material is a carbon material. It's porous. It's from, again, organic material, so we haven't burned it and sent a bunch of carbon dioxide in the air. We've actually kept it into the ground.
Right.
And then it's relatively inert. It acts as a water holding and a nutrient holding capability. And this goes all the way back to Amazonian times where the pre-Amazon times, when they had to deal with the soil that wasn't that fertile. So they found 10,000-year-old piles of, that were mixed up with this black charcoal, compost, and some bone matter. So they were managing their soil 10,000 years ago to optimize sustainable growth. And we're just going back to it. But it gives us a way to get rid of excess organic material. Some fabrics could incorporate this instead of just throwing it out there, burning it, letting it decompose. It allows us to, you know, grab all that carbon together. And I remember what I was going to say is the other thing that came from the conference is not only are trees, the proximity of the tree is very important to receiving the maximum benefits. So having a tree within 50 meters of a residence seemed to be the key distance for benefits. So even though we have beautiful trees up on the hill, we need them closer.
Right.
So we want to plant a tree in every yard.
50 meters, roughly 150 feet or so.
Stay within good canopy cover, and it's improving health.
My trees around me, they're like within 20 feet or 30 feet.
Yeah, same with my house and same with some houses. Same. But somebody
I'm not sure that that gives us defensible space, but we're going with it anyway. Right.
Yeah, you have to balance. And that's species selection also. You know, don't plant an unfire-wise house or a tree close to your house.
Right.
Like, try to get it close enough.
Yeah.
That you get some benefits. And sometimes we have to do a little bit of trade-off there, depending where you live.
All right. Jason Bartow, Executive Director with ReLeaf Utah. And remind us again the website and the Facebook page.
Website is ReLeafUtah.org. And our Facebook page is ReLeaf Utah. I think it's at ReLeaf Utah. We also have a Twitter and an Instagram account. I unfortunately am terrible at those, but I think you can find the links on our Facebook page.
Just go to your Facebook page.
Just go to Facebook.
Facebook page.
I apologize, but that's my strong suite right now.
All right. Thanks for coming by and that information. Well, hopefully we'll get a little change here in the weather. We are going to get some snow, but like I say, some single digit near zero temperatures Thursday night. And kind of bracketing it both tomorrow night and Friday night, too, until things slowly start to get back to average temperatures.
So. And for those of you that have natural Christmas trees, please don't just throw them away. We have a couple collection programs here in Park City that recycle them. But please also make sure that you keep your trees watered with them being indoors. We don't want a natural tree to turn into a fire hazard.
Right.
So please do that. But the trees are either chipped. They can be chipped up to use as bark mulch. We could turn them into biochar.
Sure.
And they're also used in stream bank restoration.
There you go.
So there's a lot of great uses that your used Christmas tree can go for. And you notice I'm not a non-proponent of Christmas tree ranching and the use of a natural tree. They provide benefits. They're doing a great job, and we get to reuse them afterwards. And I saw somewhere that actually the carbon footprint of a natural tree is like 1/30th the footprint of an artificial tree.
A plastic tree.
So I'm cool. I'll joke about Christmas and natural trees, but realistically, it's a fine practice. You do not need to feel guilty. Just
like
make sure your tree stays watered.
I like that validation.
Good.
Just water your tree
and
make sure
it
stays dry and pretty. And then make sure you recycle it. Just don't throw it out in the trash.
Right.
I think it's the Park City Boys Lacrosse Team
that
collects them.
Hook
up with them. It's a fundraiser for them. And it allows us to recycle natural resources, not fill up the landfill, and help try to keep our quality of life where it is and improving it up here.
All right. Jason, thanks again. We're out of time. Yeah, well done. All right. Let's take one last break for some underwriters. We come back. We got to pretty much wrap up. It's This Green Earth.
Hi, this is Dr. Juliana Miller from Miller Orthodontics, a proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton. With a combined 45 years of orthodontic experience, my husband and I are now raising our family and working full-time in the Park City community. There are so many reasons to smile in Park City. More information at m2ortho.com.
Support for KPCW comes from Park City Institute.
You'll jump, jive, and wail when Big Bad Voodoo Daddy swings into the Eccles Center with a high-energy jazz performance for the Park City Institute's 20th anniversary main stage season, Wednesday, December 20th. The show begins at 7:30. Tickets start at $29. Call the box office, 435-655-3114. Park City Institute is a nonprofit organization entertaining, educating, and illuminating since 1998.
Hi, I'm Beth Armstrong, director of the Promontory Foundation, a nonprofit charitable organization established by Promontory. We are pleased to support KPCW. Supporting Park City and Summit County nonprofits, the Promontory Foundation seeks to make a positive impact on conservation and family through charitable giving through Promontory and its members. Please visit PromontoryClub.com to find out more.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Time to wrap up another This Green Earth.
Yes. Let's thank our sponsors and underwriters who make this show possible. They include Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
Vail Epic Promise,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
Park City Mountain,
and of course, listeners like you.
You know, you can always email us your thoughts and comments and ideas for other shows to This Green Earth, all one word, at kpcw.org.
Remember, this is KPCW 91.7 FM Park City. We've got your Wasatch back.
Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next week. And NPR News is coming up.